With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, some changes coming for BASF Agriculture. We'll have more on that. And how you can nominate someone for a special honor at the World Dairy Expo. But kicking off our news today, billions of dollars in state, federal, and local broadband funding efforts are getting deployed to help close the nation's digital divide. Chad Smith has details.
Rick Zimmerman is Vice President of State Affairs for NCTA, the Internet and Television Association. He says new regulations from the Federal Communications Commission will harm broadband deployment to rural communities.
The FCC and the government, they're proposing some new rules and regulations that may make it more difficult for us to invest. It's already a marginal situation as to whether we invest. That's why the subsidy is necessary. There are some proposed labor rules, possible rate regulation, a number of factors that make it a marginal call to begin with. But now the FCC is proposing to institute something known as net neutrality, which really governs every aspect of our vision of internet service.
He talks about the bigger picture in closing the broadband gap.
The bigger picture is that it's sort of a regulatory agency run amok, really trying to expand its power, control the way that the private entities, private markets, serve broadband out in America. Do we go there in the first place? Well, the government is trying to change the economics by giving subsidies to go there, but then they're making it more difficult by potentially imposing all sorts of new rules and requirements, and they might blow this once-in-a-generation opportunity to bring internet to all.
Zimmerman says the FCC needs to focus more on removing roadblocks to deployment.
What they can do is remove roadblocks to deployment. One of the things that makes it more expensive to deploy broadband are things like certain permitting requirements, certain pole attachment rules and requirements, and we've got to attach to those poles. And in some cases, it is costly, and the FCC can make it easier. So there's a number of ways that they can sort of remove regulatory barriers or also these physical barriers, if you will.
State leaders can take common sense steps to help.
They can look at their highway department, look at permitting issues and pole attachment issues as well. But it's also oversight of their respective broadband offices that are in charge of distributing this federal money to ensure responsible spending. This is not just a construction project. This is an ongoing relationship between a community and an internet service provider. And so we have to look at the long-term engagement, look at engaging experienced, trusted providers as we are, folks that have ties to the local community. And states really have an important role ensuring that the money is distributed in a way that levels the playing field, but brings the expertise of existing providers to bear.
Zimmerman says the opportunity to connect all of America is there now. Success depends on removing roadblocks to broadband deployment, not adding more of them. For more information, go to ncta.com. Chad Smith reporting.
The recent United Nations Climate Change Conference gave an opportunity for U.S. leadership to showcase domestic agricultural approaches to address climate issues. Here's Rod Bain with more.
In an annual event that for the first time provided a major focus on food production and agriculture as a climate mitigator and problem solver, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack recognized that significance. In fact, the recent 28th United Nations Climate Change Conference set aside a day to recognize
Food and Agriculture Day, one of the special days, and highlighted at COP28.
His 3 days at the conference included participation in several sessions and high-level events, such as sessions updating the latest advances in the Agriculture Innovation Mission, AIM, for climate.
AIM for Climate Partners have more than doubled the total increased investment in climate-smart agriculture and food system innovation from $8 billion at COP27 to $17 billion today. We've more than doubled the number of innovation sprints since COP27 to 78, and we've more than doubled the number of partners since COP27 to over 600 now at COP28, including 55 government partners.
Another focal point of U.S. climate mitigation efforts, the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities. creating markets for commodities and services that are value added through climate smart production practices.
We specifically designed this opportunity to appeal to all types of farmers, from large farms to small family farm operations, across all major commodities, including a diverse range of farmer demographics. The project involves nearly 100 universities, including over 30 minority-serving institutions.
USDA is also part of a domestic initiative called America the Beautiful, with the goal of conserving 30% of U.S. lands and waters by the year 2030.
When it was structured, it was intended to reflect a broad range of efforts by ranchers and farmers, fishermen and women, forest owners, tribal nations, and communities to safeguard the health and the integrity of the lands and waters upon which all of us depend. For USDA, a critical part of the initiative is the inclusion of private working lands that are the backbone of many rural communities.
The secretary also conducted bilateral discussions while at COP28.
With my counterparts in Chile, France, the UK, and Mexico.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just need to get the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. Just search for AgNet NewsHour on your favorite podcast downloading app. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, at this year's National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention, I stopped by the Bear booth to learn more about their digital solutions. Here's the conversation I had.
My name is Andy Folta. I'm the U.S. Product Marketing Manager for Climate Field View with Bayer Crop Science.
Tell me a little bit about your digital solutions for ag.
Right. So Climate Field View is our digital platform, and it's essentially a one-stop shop landing page hub for farmers to be able to collect, visualize, and analyze data so they can bring in any kind of, you know, data layer as they go over their fields. Every time a farmer drives across their acres, they're generating data. A lot of them have been generating and collecting it for years and decades in some cases. FieldView gives them a place to put it so they can visualize it, pull reports, do trial analysis on it, but then also take that data and share it either to a third-party platform to utilize it in, you know, new and exciting ways, or, like we've seen with the majority of our Climate FieldView users in the U.S., take it and share it to a trusted advisor, so an agronomist or a dealer, so they can help them dig out insights on their acres.
So the sharing aspect of this, it seems that that would be very important, because it's one thing to have data. It's another thing to make sure the right people have data.
Right. And like I've said, we've seen the majority of our farmers take that data and they share it because, you know, farming is very hard. It's very taxing on farmers, and they're not making these decisions in a silo. A lot of times they're building a network around them of, you know, farm managers, agronomists, maybe some industry representatives. So we give them the option to take the data at whatever level they want. They can share a single field, specific parts of the data, or their entire operation, and they can share it to that trusted advisor so they can start to, you know, A, dig through the data and discover some insights, but also they can start to build some plans for the, you know, future year. So we have tools and capabilities for farmers and dealers where they can go in and create variable rate planting prescriptions, essentially a crop plan for next year. And then we can execute that in the cab with our connections with Precision Planting, John Deere, and all of our OEM manufacturers, so that as a dealer, I create my plan with a farmer, it syncs over to the piece of equipment, and it gets put into the acres.
So for our listeners who are hearing this and thinking, wow, this would be amazing, what should they do to get more information?
Okay, so I would do one of two things. So we have climate.com, great domain. On there we have all of our information about what the platform is, what it can offer for all of our crops, not just corn and soy, but also cotton, silage, specialty crops, you know, potatoes, tomatoes. I would also look in climate.com at our knowledge center. So support.climate.com walks through everything from creating an account all the way through generating a prescription and executing it. We also have a really dedicated field staff team of climate enablement managers. We've got about 40 across the country. So you can find their contact information, and they're really good at that boots on the ground on farm support.
Anything else our listeners should know, or do you think that covers it?
I think that covers it, but you can check out our socials and also our podcast Around the Farm to learn about all things digital ag.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's Livestock News, a recent seminar held in Mexico showcased American lamb to Mexican importers and distributors. As a major trading partner and importer of U.S. red meat, this is an important relationship for the entire red meat sector. U.S. Meat Export Federation's John Harris shares more details.
With support from USDA and the American Lamb Board, the U.S. Meat Export Federation held a seminar showcasing U.S. lamb for importers and distributors from throughout Mexico. Gary Pfeiffer, Executive Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Superior Farms, shares his thoughts on the seminar.
It was a terrific event that the team in Mexico put together, so we're really excited to be able to participate in the event. The event was held at the El Cielo Winery in the wine region of Ensenada, Mexico, so it was just a beautiful setting and had distributors and influencers from throughout Mexico that came in for the event. You know, started off with a seminar and a demonstration. Each of the representatives from the U.S. So we gave a presentation about American lamb and our company and our products, which was really well received, and we got a lot of good questions. And then from there, we had a terrific lunch, and then really spent the afternoon networking with the different distributors throughout Mexico.
Pfeiffer was especially impressed with the turnout of buyers representing Mexico's food service sector.
Mexico has always been an important export destination for us. But, you know, for us, what was really exciting about it was this really introduced us to a lot more distributors and, most importantly, a much better understanding of the food service scene in Mexico. So for us, that's where we see our greatest growth potential. After our discussions and, you know, talking about our products and seeing the quality of it and understanding more about what their needs are and what our capabilities are, there's certainly an opportunity for growth throughout Mexico with American lamb. They were very excited to hear that we offered a fresh option, because I think they're used to getting primarily frozen meat from overseas. So really being our next door neighbor and the availability of fresh lamb was very exciting to them. One of our taglines is 10,000 miles fresher, and that seemed to really resonate with the group that was there.
For more, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harreth.
In other livestock news, German company Sanara has gone public as the first European firm to work towards cell-cultured milk after months of work in secret. Aimed at conventional milk production, Sanara hopes to replace traditional milk with their cell-cultured variety. Similar to cell-cultured meat, their lab-produced milk would be made by selecting productive cells and reproducing those in a lab environment. Touted as being a friend to the planet, on their website, dairymen should be aware of this new hurdle on the horizon that will eventually compete for shelf space in grocery stores and home refrigerators. According to DairyReporter.com, Dr. Svenja Danowitz, Sanara's CEO, noted, "We don't interfere directly with the animals, which I think is a much more elegant solution." For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
How does organic production fit into a regenerative ag framework? Founder of Abundant Harvest Organics, Vernon Peterson, participated in a panel discussion titled "Regenerative: What Does It Mean for Organic?" at last month's Organic Growers Summit. Peterson shared his response to one of the questions posed to the panel.
The question was, can you be regenerative and not be organic? That was what I pointedly responded to, and my response was no, that would be impossible. There's no way you're building soil organic matter. There's no way you're stimulating biology in the soil in a chemical system. So regenerative is something that must be built on top of an organic system. Regenerative has to be built within a biological system, not within a chemical system.
How does organic production fit into a regenerative ag framework? Founder of Abundant Harvest Organics, Vernon Peterson, participated in a panel discussion titled "Regenerative: What Does It Mean for Organic?" at last month's Organic Growers Summit. Peterson shared his response to one of the questions posed to the panel.
The question was, can you be regenerative and not be organic? That was what I pointedly responded to, and my response was no, that would be impossible. There's no way you're building soil organic matter. There's no way you're stimulating biology in the soil in a chemical system. So regenerative is something that must be built on top of an organic system. Regenerative has to be built within a biological system, not within a chemical system.
The America's Farms and Ranches at a Glance report from USDA shows that 88% of farms are considered small family farms. USDA economic researcher Catherine Lacey said the small family farm category is divided into four different typology groups.
A retirement farm is a small farm with a principal operator who reports having retired from farming while continuing to farm on a small scale. An off-farm occupation farm is a farm with a principal occupator who reports a primary occupation other than farming. We have farming occupation farms with a principal operator who reports farming as their primary occupation, and this category is split into two groups, low sales or farming occupation farms with gross cash farm income less than $150,000 a year. Moderate sales are farming occupation farms with gross cash farm income greater than or equal to $150,000 and less than $350,000 a year.
The Pierce's Disease and Glassy Winged Sharpshooter Board is now accepting research funding applications. The PD GWIS board is offering grant funding for research and outreach projects aimed at safeguarding vineyards, preventing wine grape pests and diseases, and promoting sustainable solutions. Project proposals are due via online submission by January 31st. In the previous round, the board allocated $2.7 million to 17 research projects focusing on Pierce's disease, grapevine viruses, and vectors spanning a three-year period. The board's research and outreach program has supported 282 grants since 2001, investing $42.5 million in PD and GWIS research and $12.4 million in research related to other pests and diseases. Those interested can access more information and submit proposals on the PD GWIS board website. The World Dairy Expo is currently accepting nominations for the 2024 Recognition Awards. The awards acknowledge outstanding contributions in three categories: Dairy Producer of the Year, Industry Person of the Year, and International Person of the Year. Dairy producers excelling in production, animal breeding, and management practices are eligible for the first category, while the second category recognizes individuals in research, education, marketing, or manufacturing within the U.S. The International Person of the Year award is for those outside the U.S. contributing to international dairy industry fields. Nominations will be accepted through February 1st and are open to organizations, academic staff, and industry professionals. The selected recipients will be honored during the World Dairy Expo next October. Additional information and the nomination form are available on worlddairyexpo.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
A look ahead to what 2024 may bring for the dairy industry, that's coming up on This Land of Ours.
For milk producers, what can they expect in the moo year to come?
Year over year, milk production is expected to increase, as it always does.
Always does, but USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Jekanowski says it's the size of the increase that is sometimes hard to predict, but he's going to take a whack at it.
2024 milk production is at 229 billion pounds compared to 226.9 billion pounds this year.
Or an increase of a little less than 1%. As far as the prices that milk will bring,
we actually expect the all milk price to average a little bit lower next year in 2024. Our forecast right now is $20.25 per hundredweight.
So that 1% increase in milk production could bring on a 1.5% drop in the all milk price. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
One out of five Americans live in an area that requires use of a septic system or other individual decentralized wastewater unit as a means to protect health and safety in the event of a system failure.
What this memorandum of understanding does is allows us to partner with a bunch of different agencies to ensure that we're bringing all the resources of government to bear to help people across rural America.
USDA Rural Development Rural Utilities Service Administrator Andrew Burke says the MOU was originally developed by the Environmental Protection Agency in 2005, with USDA joining the Memorandum of Understanding last month.
It allows us to be at the table with other people advocating for rural America and making sure that the resources that they have come to our communities, that if there are places maybe that we haven't had relationships with in the past that EPA or others know is an issue, that we can get to them.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. One of the first conferences of 2024 will be the Clean Fuels Conference, February 5th through 8th in Fort Worth, Texas. Chuck Zimmerman recently talked with Clean Fuels Director of Outreach and Development, Tom Vary, about the conference and what attendees can expect. Here is that conversation.
I'm visiting with Tom Vary with the Clean Fuels Alliance. And Tom, first of all, I want to talk a little bit about the fact that we have another conference coming up, first of the year, basically. Is there anything you want to tell us to let people know what you guys are going to do this year?
Well, thank you, Chuck. Yeah, absolutely. Our conference is coming up in Fort Worth, first week of February. And I think our conference is really going to showcase how our industry has evolved over this past year. We got new markets that are very interested in using our fuels, biodiesel and renewable diesel, to help reduce their carbon emissions, their carbon footprint. And so a couple of industries really going to showcase are marine and rail. So they are both getting a lot of pressure from their customers to reduce their carbon emissions, to help their customers reduce their carbon emissions. And that's that portends very good things for biodiesel and renewable diesel producers.
And rail is still an incredibly important part of our supply chain, right?
Oh, extremely. Our industry relies on the bringing the inputs and taking our outputs and get it all over the country. As you know, Chuck, most of our fuel is produced in the middle part of the country, and we ship it to the coast, east, west, and west, and east coast, west coast. So, yeah, absolutely critical.
This industry has really changed from back when we had the first conference as the biodiesel conference, and now it's Clean Fuels. How would you characterize what it was then and where it may be now?
Well, yeah, we both go a long ways back, don't we, Chuck? I think 2006 was our first conference in Palm Springs. And so we had no idea what to expect. We thought maybe if 300 people would show up, it would be a hit. 600 people showed up, and just we were overwhelmed and in a good way. And so I think we kind of, the first conference, I think we framed it, is where Woodstock and Wall Street met. Remember that? We had a lot of people maybe on the Woodstock side and a lot of people on the Wall Street side. But we all came together and we all agreed on biodiesel and now, of course, renewable diesel. So there's still a lot to that. And I think, you know, looking at our conference coming up in early part of next year, it's going to be probably more business focused than it has in those early days, where a lot of our producer members meet with their customers and do the deals. A lot of fuel is sold, renewable diesel, biodiesel is sold during the conference. You know, a lot of our producer members are booked all day long doing customer meetings. So it's been a really great platform for our industry to come together and conduct business. But, you know, we still like to have a little of that Woodstock. We still have the environmental community is very important to us. And so there will be represented. We're going to be talking about how we're getting our carbon down, how we're working with environmental justice communities to work with them. They have a serious communities located by the ports and the rail yards, the truck yards. In the Midwest, we enjoy all this nice clean air. But my friends on the East Coast that live by the ports said, well, all the stuff that you buy comes through this port, and I gotta breathe this air. So it's a fair point. So, and we can help clean up that with our fuels and biodiesel, renewable diesel. So we're going to be talking about that. I'm looking forward to it. It's always great. A lot of great energy, and looking forward to meeting a lot of people you only see during the conference.
It's kind of like we've gone from the tie-dye T-shirt to the coat and tie, you know, where we had people like a Willie Nelson or a Daryl Hannah to, you know, people now who are leaders in major corporate entities, you know, and it has been a real evolution as the industry's grown.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Chuck. That's we had a lot of grassroots environmentalist involvement, and we still do. They really came with a different approach. They mostly are, you know, Palm Springs. A lot of them are coming from California. So, you know, there's pretty hardcore environmentalists there, and most of us were coming to the Midwest, probably not so much like that, but we came together and we figured out how to work together, because we both see the value in what our fuels can do. And so that's kind of the neat part. And you mentioned Daryl Hannah and Willie Nelson, and gosh, we had a lot of celebrities in the early days. And now I guess our celebrities are now, are, you know, we get like Pepsi on stage talking about they want to use biodiesel in their fleet, and Maersk Shipping using biodiesel on the high seas, and Southwest Airlines want to use SAF, sustainable aviation fuel. So it's been exciting to have those, still having the celebrities, but maybe a little different form now.
Well, we are looking forward to another great conference coming up in Fort Worth real soon after the first of the year, and a good time for those in the Midwest, because, you know, we're south where it's a little warmer maybe at that point.
Yeah, it'll be better than mid-Missouri, I'm sure. We hope so. But, you know, Chuck, you've been part of this from the beginning, so you've been able to see this, the changes and the growth, so it's been exciting. So it's been great to have you be part of our team from the very get-go.
Well, we were, you know, with the headquarters in Jefferson City. We just happened to be there when I was managing the what's now Brownfield Ag News. So it was, we've always had a great relationship and have thoroughly enjoyed working with y'all.
Sunny beaches of Florida. So.
Great to talk to you, Tom, and give us a little bit of a retrospective of over the years with the what's now Clean Fuels Conference. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Brian German has today's featured interview.
Tim Fredericks, Environmental Engagement Manager.
And we're here at the Almond Conference, and you are highlighting kind of several aspects here. And one thing is the Bayer for Biodiversity kind of initiative and platform. So let's kind of start there with just a holistic, well, what is it?
So Bayer for Biodiversity is a program where we partner with conservation groups, educators, academics, and really people that are involved in adding more diverse habitat to the agricultural landscape.
And then as part of that, there are several notable partners that you guys work with as part of that. They're here as well. What are some of those partnerships, and how do they get explained to the grower?
So one that we'll mention right away is Project Apis M. They have a program called Seeds for Bees. It's a free cover crop seed program, typically used in tree crops in between the rows. And what it does is they're looking to really add blooming forage for bees that are brought in to pollinate the crops early in the season. So not only helps with bee health, native pollinators and managed pollinators on those lands, but also has a multitude of benefits for the on-farm, building soil, organic matter, and infiltration of water, and the benefits to adding those cover crops early in the season are really multiplicative.
And there's also one that we were talking about just a second ago, focused on monarchs and some of the efforts there as well.
Yeah, so Monarch Joint Venture is here as well. They have a Monarchs and More California Habitat Program, and that one's really looking at adding this diverse diverse permanent habitat now, not a cover crop, but something that's going to stay and be a perennial and in an off-field area, so off the farm where you're growing the actual crop, but on farm in those edge habitats where maybe it's a turn row, it's next to a barn, it's somewhere else that's being managed not for a crop but just managed on the farm. And so those areas can really add nuggets of habitat that are perennial and long-term for native species.
And overall, the initiative and the efforts there are just kind of about taking a holistic approach at pollinators and other wild species, just to help those things out and not just the farmer itself, right?
Yeah, so this is building the big picture, right? So, like, we're growing crops for us, but we've also displaced a lot of wildlife in having farms, right, and having urbanization. So the more we can add habitat back to the ag landscape for wildlife, for pollinators, to increase biodiversity in these spaces, the better that's going to be for all of society.
And that's what some of this is, by taking some of that land that's on workable farmland, and wherever you can implement some of these partnerships, it seems like it's a win-win for everybody involved.
Yeah, I really, this is one of those programs where it's like a shining star, right? Like, there's no real negative to this other than, you know, there might be a little bit of effort to put it in and manage it and establish it, but there actually are really some good programs available to help growers with those financial startup costs and also the technical knowledge that they would need to be putting this habitat in.
And then you also sit in a regulatory kind of conversation that takes place. And how important is the idea of biodiversity in those conversations with trying to explain, you know, the grower's part in trying to get back or build up those habitats and the environment itself?
Right. So the idea there is that we're really not just doing no harm, but we're actually doing something beneficial on top of that, right? So like we're adding this habitat back and providing habitat for species that have been displaced potentially, right? So instead of just being protective to not impact non-target species on farm, we're providing habitat for them to benefit those species on farm.
And also some of those species, especially in almonds, are incredibly important, such as pollinators. So it's in the grower's best interest as well to provide that habitat.
Yeah, so I mean, almonds especially, we're at the almond conference, right? So I mean, I think it's 95% of all honeybees in North America end up in almonds at the beginning of the season, right? So the more we can help those bees be healthy early in the season through additional forage on the landscape, the better they're going to be throughout the rest of the season to produce a honey crop and stay healthy.
And now lastly here, because you guys are involved in so many different efforts, where can people go to maybe learn more about it, check out what there is out there?
Yeah, so a lot of our partnerships and the people that we really engage with in this space can be found at go.bayer.com/biodiversity.
Thank you, Brian. We will be right back. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour. And now for more news, many U.S. agricultural products are shipped through the Mississippi River to the Panama Canal and then out to their destinations. But a lack of rainfall has caused several issues along the route. Eric Pfeiffer is in Panama to get a firsthand look at the situation.
We've been talking for 2 years now about the water levels on the Mississippi River and how that's negatively impacting shipping times for grain. But similar issues are holding up grain barges here in Central America. The Indiana Soybean Alliance and some of their farmer directors are in Panama with me this week to get a firsthand look at the issues we're seeing at the canal. Mike Caney farms in southeastern Indiana and serves on the executive board of the Soy Transportation Coalition. He explains why this is so important to U.S. farmers.
So number one commodity through here is always containers. That's the number one thing that they ship through here. There's about 30 million containers a year go through the Panama Canal. You know, how many of them are ag products? I don't really know, but there's probably quite a few with the container beans and with the chilled meat and stuff like that that we have that we ship overseas. And then, you know, number two is bulk ag commodities. So when you start talking number two, that's a big number when you start, and it sure adds up after a while if everything slows down and we can't get that product through.
Our tour guide, Ricardo, tells us that Panama typically receives around 130 inches of rain a year. This year was about half of that due to El Nino. How bad is the logjam due to drought?
They're talking, you know, 18 to 22 days out getting through the canal now. So that's a long time to be waiting to get through.
Currently, they're only allowing about half the traffic through the canal as usual. Caney will have continued meetings this week at the Panama Canal with the Soy Transportation Coalition. He says the rest of the Indiana Soybean Alliance group will meet with other groups working to move the soybean pile in the region for progress updates.
The U.S. Meat Export Federation and the U.S. Poultry and Egg Export and USEC, which is the U.S. Soy Export Council, and they're going to learn more about what goes on down here and the projects. We do have projects that we fund down here in Panama too, so they're going to learn about that kind of stuff, and it should be a very informative couple days here.
And we'll be visiting markets and stores offering Indiana and U.S. food products. I'll have much more from my trip to Central America in the coming days. From the Panama Canal, I'm Eric Pfeiffer.
A brand new book will help teach the kids in your life about agriculture. CJ Miller has more.
The book is called The Young American Farmer, and it's written by Courtney Oddie, an ag education major at Purdue University. Audie shared with me where the idea for the book came from.
At the end of the day, agriculture has left such a big impact on me, and I feel like I tend to take it for granted sometimes. And so I really want to sit down, look at it through this lens of childlike joy, or how would a child look at agriculture if they'd never seen it before? And so then I really started to dissect it, and I actually got a puppy a couple weeks ago, and her name is Millie. And so she kind of kickstarted the whole idea of the character, where I was like, if Millie was a kid, what would I tell her about agriculture? Which is quite a funny connection there.
She says the main lesson of the book is that agriculture provides us all with so much more than just the food we eat.
Agriculture is more than the corn and the soybean fields I grew up with, and like the pigs and the cows. It's the cotton fields in the southern half of the United States. It's the grapevines. It's the apple orchards. And so I really wanted to capitalize on all of agriculture, so that way it can kind of bring about those deeper conversations with children. So then we can talk about how everything we use comes from agriculture. Like, I wouldn't be sitting in the Purdue University Union if it wasn't for agriculture, because of the wood. And so I think it brings recognition to all of these different areas of agriculture.
Audie says the profits from the book are going to a program to help further ag education in our schools.
All the profits from this book are going to go into this program to help create small urban farms for urban schools. So think vertical gardens, smaller things like that. So that way these students can actively see, even if I'm not on a 100-acre farm, I can still be involved in agriculture. I can still grow my own food. And my hope is that the money from this going and supporting these programs not only better prepares Purdue students, but also allows these urban students to see agriculture and see it in a different light.
You can find Courtney Audie's new children's book called The Young American Farmer at Amazon.com. I'm CJ Miller.
Will beef prices continue to rise next year? Here's Carrie Crawford to tell us.
Cow-calf operators seem to be continuing to send more animals to feedlots than normal, sooner than normal.
Higher placements happening right now are going to translate into a little bit larger supplies in the first few months of 2024.
But USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says supplies of cattle in 2024 as a whole will still be lower than this year. And as to prices, they've been running a little lower than expected recently.
But still, overall, steer prices are relatively strong and expected to increase in 2024.
For this year, steer prices are expected to average a very high 175.55 hundredweight.
We expect that to increase next year with even tighter supplies to $178.25 per hundredweight.
A 1.5% increase as cattle supplies tighten, sending 2024 beef production down by 3.5%. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
There's a little less optimism about the ag economy going into 2024 than heading into 2023. Chad Hart is an Iowa State University professor who says the outlook for the year is not entirely gloomy. He says it may be a case of things returning to normal.
The idea is, I'm going to describe it as, we're returning back to normal. When you think back at 2020, 2021, 2022, what we had were some very strong years for the farm economy. And the idea is, we couldn't expect that to continue. We've seen our prices decline. We're seeing things tighten up as far as profit margins are concerned. But for most commodities, I would argue we're around break even, which I would argue is around normal.
He says the ag sector does have its challenges.
Now, we've got our definite weak spots. Dairy has struggled hard in 2023. Pork has struggled as well significantly. But when you're looking at some of our crops like corn and soybeans, I'm going to argue, no, they're settling back in towards prices equal production cost, which is the normal state of affairs.
High input costs have squeezed margins in the last few years. Hart says it's a different situation than what was considered normal before 2020.
Say you go back 5-10 years ago, yes, we would have been talking lower prices and lower costs. Now we're talking higher prices and higher costs. So prices don't have to fall back to where they were to create problems for us. Think of it as the profits we've gathered over the past few years, we've reinvested that back in agriculture. By that reinvestment, we have driven those input costs up to match the prices we have today.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet NewsHour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.